Hello and welcome to Studio Sessions, the big red and shiny podcast where we talk with artists about the ideas, inspiration, and processes that go into creating their work. I'm your host Matt Coleman, and our guest this episode is Kirk Snow. Kirk earned a BA in Art History in 2002 from the University of Rhode Island, a BA in Printmaking in 2003, also from the University of Rhode Island, and is a 2011 MFA graduate from the School of the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston. Kirk's pieces typically involve the use of construction materials and motifs. Sometimes he approaches his pieces more sculpturally with installations of physical works. Other times he works more performatively, such as using a palm sander to wear through the surface of a coffee table. Join me as he discusses his creative process and the different themes that he is exploring through these pieces. Hi, Kirk. How are you doing today?
Doing pretty good, Matt.
Thanks for being here. Where would you like to start talking about your work and where you're coming from and where you're going?
Well, since we're right in front of a computer, you have a really good, transitional work for me. It's titled When Transition Becomes Stasis. It was a piece I made during graduate school. It was really the first time I started delving into using materials that I would sort of associate with suburban remodeling and sort of a visual culture around that kind of activity.
So right here you've got some drywall mounted on to about a 6 foot or 8 foot ladder there that's standing upright. Is that what's happening?
Yep. And you can see it's got the aluminum studs too, which I really kind of associate with that idea of expansion. Even though, you know, wood studs are probably just as common, I think it seems a lot more quick and a lot less permanent, which was a really key point to me when I was starting through this series of work. Previous to that, my practice had been really focusing on performative work for a few years, and this was really the piece that was kind of bringing me back to being a maker of concrete things, but while still exploring some of the same ideas that I was interested in, just about the sort of the tendencies, the things that happened in the suburbs that I had observed that I kind of began to associate with what develops into the housing crisis and sort of the self constructs and the things that were almost like sort of like the psychological stuff that leads to the thought that then leads to buying more than you can actually afford, and you know, things along those lines, and sort of the facades that happen from a sort of keep up with your neighbors mentality.
So in this latter piece here, it looks pretty like temporary, I would say. It's not a concrete structure. Is that kind of what you were going for, was the kind of slapped together?
Yeah. There's definitely these temporary clamps, which are not necessarily construction clamps, but they're really about something in process, something that's happening in a moment, not meant to be permanent, but it's still house materials, things that we associate with a certain amount of permanence,
the structures that we create for ourselves to live in, essentially.
Yeah, I've been reading this Michael Pollan book, A Place of One's Own, recently, and he wrote this thing about sort of the history of construction of the suburbs and like these kinds of materials, specifically about how the suburbs caused the invention of, you know, balloon frames, which is, you know, like the stud construction that most modern buildings are based on, and how at the time that was associated with such a thing of impermanence, but now it's become, because it's about home, it has this sort of dual meaning. Like, it's still not a really long-lasting structure, but because it's homes, there's a certain life to it and history to it as well.
How were buildings built before that? Because I know even as far back as the late 1800s, they were using kind of stud frame construction on Victorian-era houses.
Yeah, so I guess stud frames comes in somewhere in the early 1800s.
Mm-hmm.
I guess just before the Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess it really comes out of the Midwest, from what I understand of the history of it. The manufacturing of 2x4s and studs replaces timber frame and brick construction, because they're easily shippable materials. So they could be shipped out into the plains from places like Chicago or from the Pacific Northwest, or at that time still the Northeast too, from logging communities by train and stuff.
Yeah, being from Kansas, I guess that's why I think stud frames, that's the only way to build stuff. That's all that it is out there.
Yeah. It's weird when you come, like, I go back to Arizona with my wife a lot because that's where she's originally from. And, even though, like, I grew up in a suburb, I definitely, there are old timber frame farmhouses around where I grew up too.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, it's funny to see not like a single building for miles and miles made out of anything other than, you know, 2x4s, because there's definitely a different kind of construction that can happen because of that change.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And did you grow up in the suburbs? Is that where those ideas are coming from?
Yeah. So I grew up in a suburb just north of Providence, Rhode Island. It's Lincoln. It's in the Blackstone Valley. So it's part of the really old industrial corridor that follows the Blackstone River. And so a lot of the towns are mixtures of old farms and various kinds of, mostly textile factories and stuff. So and there are lots of small villages along the water and formerly farming communities kind of a little bit inland. And in the section of Blackstone Valley I grew up in the 50s and then again in the 80s, families sold off farms and they start getting chopped up for suburban development.
Right. So you saw a lot of new construction going on when you were living there?
Yeah. I definitely, as a kid when we first moved there from the city, I was surrounded by woods. By the time I was out of undergrad, there isn't woods for like 2.5-3 miles from my parents' house now. Everything was just kind of cleared and opened up again.
That sounds about exactly like my experience growing up. Like,
it's a really weird American thing, especially I think of our generation, because the suburbs were just so popular.
Yeah, just through the 80s and 90s, everything just exploded outwards, and
exactly
acres and acres got consumed for houses that were slapped up literally overnight.
Yeah, it's really true. And I think it's really strange to go back and visit my parents now, because there was such an expansion. Now there's sort of like an emptiness. There's a lot of like half developed, you know, housing developments, specifically of like kind of like the McMansion quality home.
Yeah.
which is really kind of strange, because I mean there's a whole probably mile and a half stretch right off the highway near where my parents are that's just empty McMansions. Only like three or four families moved in.
Has anyone ever lived in those, or they just didn't?
Some of them I don't think have ever been lived in, which is kind of I think a really interesting thing.
Are they getting really decrepit, or does somebody upkeep them?
The ones I see, the there must be a development corporation that kind of at least keeps up the yard.
Mm-hmm.
But
inside, don't go in there.
yeah. I wonder. It really makes me think, like, what's going on inside. Some of them are so close to highways and stuff. I wonder if they're kind of like shaking. what's cracking? What's actually stable? Yeah.
Yeah, with the McMansions, I actually read some architectural criticism and opinion about how the modern trend is not even just like the cookie cutter houses, but like kind of theme park development of neighborhoods, and they kind of create this faux environment that it's really an unusual phenomenon, I think.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely something like I've been really interested in my work. You know, those developments like Celebration that Disney developed, which was based on the cinematic or televisual version of the 50s community.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like every house is, the development's designed in a way where almost every house is on a cul-de-sac.
Mm-hmm.
And every house has to have a white picket fence. And when you don't keep up with that, like, the housing board kind of gets on with you.
Mm. I've heard of that place. Where is that exactly? Is it in Florida?
Yeah, it's a community sort of near Orlando. It's part of the larger sort of Disney. it's literally a Disney town. And there's some places, some interesting places like that in Arizona too. There's a town called Anthem, where it's like every so many blocks there's like kind of a shopping center and like the cul-de-sac thing, and you know, schools. It's almost like a repetitive small town.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, those things are really interesting to me, because I think they rely so heavily on a construction of what suburban living is.
Mm.
And there's a certain amount of suppression of variety.
Yeah.
And it takes, and I'm really interested in the fact that it takes a lot of effort to keep that up.
Yeah, it requires a lot of infrastructure just to do that. It's not efficient setup. It's efficient as far as making money quickly for the developers, but sustaining it, it's not very good.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's like, homogeneity is not natural, you know. It takes a lot of work to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's like a lot of what I've been interested in work over the last couple of years, is that effort and that desire to project that homogeneity, because it's because people are unique and different, and, and that's really interesting to some people, but there's also a desire to kind of suppress that too.
And so, getting back to your work on that subject, then, how are some of these ideas of suburbia and real estate development playing out in these works here?
Talk about maybe a couple of these pieces from the What Lies Beneath series. I like to borrow titles from sort of lots of cinematic references. Also a lot of like really a certain generation of like punk rock and hardcore, that, you know, the really sort of suburban hatred kind of generation of titles. So they're both like really some of the when I pull from that, it's, you know, a lot of titles that are both like sort of like poetic and but like also really kind of like innocent and crude too.
Mm.
But so this whole series was kind of playing with various ideas of using drywall and sort of patches and holes in drywall playing with the sort of spaces in walls, but also with a lot of these works, just the idea of facades.
Mm-hmm.
So this, I think, I'm trying to remember how many actual pieces, and they've all been numbered, and some of them
mm-hmm.
have been done multiple times, so the ordering of them is a little unclear in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
But I think this one was probably the first one in idea, but maybe a later one in execution. And it's just a simple, almost, I guess, like wall drawing. It uses sort of the drywall mesh tape, spackle, and a couple screws. And it looks as though it's a wall patch,
uh-huh.
like sort of, you know, three quarters of the way done. It hasn't been painted yet.
Mm-hmm.
It's been sanded smooth. It's ready. It's ready for that final state. But it's actually all just a surface. It doesn't...
Okay.
There's no actual
damage. You didn't break a hole in there?
No. So there was no actual damage to the wall. It was sort of...
Mm-hmm.
It's just a facade of that patching gesture.
Do you think it would have been different if you had punched a hole in the wall and repaired it?
Yeah. I mean, it's the difference between real damage and the projection of an idea of damage.
Okay.
And or the projection of an idea of repair too, or fixing.
Mm.
I like that that really old, almost Renaissance archetype of the artist as like kind of like a trickster, someone who's
mm-hmm.
you know kind of messing with you a little bit.
Yeah.
And I think there's an interesting relationship to that and how sort of developers work in suburbs, you know, in terms
mm-hmm.
of trying to get out all these homes as quickly as possible with the least amount of effort.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I guess going back to when my folks moved to the suburb, and I remember a couple years in, all the houses in our neighborhood had were part of a lawsuit to the developer because of one of these things.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody bought into a look, but not sort of neglected to think about the quality.
Yeah.
And then someone had to be responsible for the quality, and I guess the developer was deemed responsible for it
yeah.
rather than the consumer, the person buying it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that situation really sort of, again, kind of gets back to sort of what's happened more recently. There's predatory lending, but there's also the idea like of people really kind of reaching outside their means sometimes too,
mm-hmm.
and sort of a mutual blame that maybe needs to
yeah.
kind of get talked about a little bit too. I mean, and there's no right or wrong. It's sort of like both.
Yeah. What are some of these pieces where you have signs facing the wall? It's like a large sign frame.
These are some more recent pieces. I wanted to kind of maybe step away from the actual like structures of the home and just sort of look a little bit more of the fragments or the remainders of development that were happening.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking about these signs that sort of are left at the edge of like half finished developments, half finished building projects.
Announcing like Springtown coming soon.
In Boston, I think about it with all these sort of like high rise apartments or things. The big one of discussion in Boston is always the Downtown Crossing, the Filene's basement development, where this company tore down virtually a historic. It was a historic department store to put up a new high-rise living and shopping center, they ran out of money and there's like a hole in the ground. Yeah. But there's, you know, and for ages there was still this sign, and it was, you know, the sign part is super slick. You know, it's really designed with
they
like
a
nice.
A lot of money.
Yeah, and there's a there's a really nice like, you know, architectural rendering and things like that, and it says coming soon, and then the sign's held up by 2x4s, and you know. Zip tied to a fence, and I thought that I kind of feel like there's something really telling in that sort of contrast.
Yeah, it is really flimsy construction.
Holding up a really slick advertising. So I wanted to play with that. So I started kind of appropriating sort of the construction part as a way to hold up a sign face that just projects color onto a wall. I wanted to play with that sort of that positioning, that sort of gesture. It's almost like facing something to a wall is almost like shameful. So I kind of wanted to play with that structure.
I saw they're only about like 3 or 4 inches away from the wall, and you can kind of see the color that you put on there reflected back out the sides a little bit.
Yeah. And I build them mostly out of scraps that are around the studio. My studio mate and I were involved in a studio space, an alternative space, and when we moved out, we tried to reclaim a lot of the wood for I don't know. Who knows what we were trying to reclaim it for? Maybe for the next alternative space that never happened. So it was, it kind of, you know, seemed to fit with the idea much better too. Using all that reclaimed wood. Because there's a certain shoddiness, temporariness, quickness to that kind of construction.
Yeah.
That really makes for the contrast.
Is there anything on the signs besides just flat color?
No, I've been playing just with the flat color at this point. I wanted something that would radiate out a little bit, that would create an effect, but not necessarily be, you know, textual or like visual. I wanted it to be a bit more ambiguous. I don't know. I'm also a sculpture nerd, so there's definitely like a little bit of like a Donald Judd play going on that I wanted to sort of play with too, because I think there's a certain history embedded in minimalism, in post-minimal work that has a lot to do with this similar mindset to like how. To the other ideas I'm talking about. I mean, if you think about some of like the Smithson earthworks and how they really actually don't account very well for the environment. They're actually really destructive and, and you know, and sort of beautiful in their destructiveness, but I think that's interesting. I think places like, you know, Marfa, where you can go visit and see Judd's studio, and it's this decrepit airplane hangar that's forgotten, in, you know, sort of in contrast to, you know, his materials. I think there's something interesting about that history too that I'm definitely trying to borrow or play with a little bit too.
Aside from these signs and the lighter, were there other more permanent structures, as you called them, that you've been doing lately, as opposed to the performative pieces you're doing?
I would say these are,
I guess, the wall patch, the faux wall patch we talked about too. But.
Yeah, I would say that's kind of been the with a lot of this. Mostly, the sculpture work has kind of played with these two ideas. The facade or the surface, it's kind of something I played a lot with. Like, there's another sort of a few other pieces that really play with that. Like, this particular one here is like a false door. So it's
not actually a doorway that's boarded over there?
No. So this particular piece has a... the plywood is like inlaid into the wall. This photo sometimes requires some contrast adjustments, but it has like an edge to it, like there had been some molding around a doorway that's been pulled off. So that was actually just painted onto the wall like that to kind of to mimic that. Even just down to the screw holes and everything, which you can see in sort of larger images of it, were all sort of created as a facade.
Yeah, it looks really convincing. It looks like a real doorway.
Yeah. I think the only hint is the sort of the gallery wall effect right there, where it's like there's actually the little gap from the gallery wall.
Yeah.
I even put in some molding all along the bottom of, the of that wall to kind of get that effect. So those have kind of been the themes and sort of the sculptural work over the last couple of years, and they've found their way into some of the performance work too. So this was a piece where I took an IKEA lac table, which I think of IKEA as this really interesting sort of product line of both like good design is sort of like this really kind of almost like, you know, upper middle class idea, but IKEA is about, you know, the affordable good design.
Yeah.
So to get affordable good design, you have this quality issue. So, you know, IKEA.
Yeah, this coffee table we're sitting next to right here is IKEA. And
yep, and I can tell you this is from the lac line.
Yeah,
and it's hollow core. And
yeah, I put this together, and it's kind of full, like packed, glued together sawdust. It's kind of like cheap MDF, is what it looked like.
Yeah, yeah. And the interesting thing, and I can show you a photo from the sort of more sculptural remnant from this line, is there's honeycomb cardboard in the middle.
Wow,
and unlike some even more expensive veneer work, IKEA uses lithograph images of wood. So the surface of this is all actually paper.
Interesting.
So you can it's a really interesting surface, especially the one I use for this piece was the birch veneer. And you can see on some of them the edge where it repeats.
Mm-hmm.
Like one of these legs actually right there has an edge that repeats from the paper. So for this performance, I actually took a belt sander or actually a palm sander and sanded away some of the surface until you get through the lithograph surface, you get through the MDF, and then there's this hollow cardboard honeycomb in the middle. And I left that as a sort of a remnant piece during the exhibition that followed the performance.
So like with the piece, like this remnant table, is it something you would keep around and redisplay again?
Yeah, I've definitely keep it around. In terms of performance work, I'm not super drawn to the idea of re-performing a work. I think it really... Reperforming has to really, for me, be important to the meaning of the work for me to actually want to do something again. Because there's a certain amount of learning and knowledge that happens through doing that. When you do something again, it's different, you know? So I try to prepare and treat performance like a studio practice, but I also don't... That means once the work is done, it tends to be done.
Mm-hmm.
So... I like the idea of keeping, especially sculptural remnants, as something that really sort of speaks as evidence back to something happening, rather than some other forms of documentation. Yeah.
And so how long does it take a palm sander to get to the hollow core of a lac table?
I think it was about 25 minutes.
That's longer than I thought it would be. That's a while.
Yeah, it's...
Did you have to replace the sandpaper several times, or did you just keep going?
No, I just kept going. I just sort of sat behind it and got in a really meditative state. And then once the little vacuum bag filled up, it definitely started filling the room with sawdust. There's some funny pictures of, like, someone in the audience that had black pants on, and their front of their pants is just kind of turned a little bit tan.
Yeah.
There's a little layer of, like, plastic in there, too, that was really weird. That's, like, that white. I think it's what they adhere the like, lithograph to.
That's what gives it the real structure, is the plastic.
Yeah, not the veneer. So, simultaneously to all this sculpture work, I've sort of been involved in loosely in this circuit of sort of venues that host performance work. I went to grad school at the Museum School in Boston, and they have a really strong connection to this sort of circuit of performance art that's really, I guess, starts solidifying in, like, the mid-70s. They were really generous in helping me actually do some traveling for some work as a grad student and then postgrad as well.
Mm-hmm.
So some of the other work you've seen on my site that's more performative is from, like, events like that. And they tend to be really different from my sculptural practice. The nature of them tends to be very different. It's really, especially when you're traveling, it tends to be about a different kind of site specificity, because you can't necessarily bring your normal materials everywhere you go.
Yeah.
So it really requires you to think a different way. It helps. It's a really interesting process for me, because I feel like I'm a really, like, sort of try again, try kind of guy, and you sort of can't do that in these situations. You just kind of have to come up, you maybe have a day or two to come up with, you can propose something, then you get there and you have to figure out whether that's actually going to work, or you proposing something new. So it can be a pretty interesting and sort of crazy experience.
Mm. Like, I could see in that crowbar piece that you were just looking at there, this crowbar in the street, and it says it's in France, and being over in a country where they don't have the same kind of development that they do in the United States, were you going from a different angle on the work there?
Well, it was interesting. I just brought up another photo from that same trip, from that same performance festival, which was from the Live Action series. It's a series of curated performance festivals that happens in a number of different cities annually. This one was from Sète, which is in the south of France, in 2010. And the piece I proposed to do was this particular one here, where in a cobblestone street, removing one of the cobblestones, cleaning it off, painting the underside white with sort of white house paint, letting it dry, and then replacing it back in the road. This was the piece I had proposed, and it was something that I was interested in trying, that related a lot more to this, some of the more sculptural works. And I got there, and they asked me if I would, or asked me, sort of expected me to perform multiple days.
Mm-hmm.
And I had only proposed this one work. So based on a conversation of what happened during this performance with a local artist, other European artists, and Scandinavian artists who observed, they talked to me about this idea and how a lot of cities when you see someone pulling up cobblestones with crowbars, it means there's going to be a riot or a protest the next day. And
so they plan ahead by pulling them up. They're like, we're going to tear things up tomorrow. I better get my cobblestones.
Apparently, European anarchist protests are very organized. I never knew this. Portland, you guys couldn't learn.
Organized anarchists.
Yep. So they had gotten me a crowbar for the first performance, and I didn't end up using it. On another day, I actually went and found in a similar marketplace to where I was, and you know, it's pretty upscale market. In the photo, you can see there's like a Sephora and like really, it's really sort of nice marketplace and set. I actually found a place where the cobblestone was already missing. And I just walked up and jammed the crowbar in the ground underneath another cobblestone and left it.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of let some people that were doing documentation take some various photos for it. And so it was a really interesting piece to kind of play, respond off of that first piece, and also create this new situation in a place where I'm not completely familiar with, based off of conversations with people who are more familiar. Mm-hmm. Really kind of respond to that. It was interesting to hang back and kind of watch. A guy went around and started asking people whose crowbar that was, because yeah. it was a really nice crowbar and nobody should leave it in the street. And then that,
yeah, shame to lose such a crowbar.
Yeah, it stayed there for about 4 or 5 hours and the crowbar disappeared. And then the next day came back and the city had repaired the spot, so there was a new cobblestone where the one had been missing, and it had probably been missing for a while too.
Yeah.
It was patched over with a brand new set.
The crowbar.
I'm assuming. I just like to assume that guy took it. Yeah. I don't know for sure.
One piece that I know you did with some traveling that seems pretty different from the rest of your work is you made a bed out of frozen tundra or something in the forest.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, this was sort of one of my earlier performative works, and it's just a piece that's really stuck with me. And I think it's one of those few performances that I've done that really lends itself to images. So I try to keep it around on the website. It was one of the works I made at a residency in Sunshine, Alaska, which is about 45 minutes south of Talkeetna, where everybody starts their treks to Denali. Mm-hmm. And it's about an hour north of Wasilla, where
little Sarah Palin's
from. Wasilla's surprisingly big.
Yeah.
You can't see very far from it either. But so this residency, it's called the Homestead AK. It's run by a really great guy, Chuck Cheney. It's an old homesteading property that was in his family.
Mm-hmm.
I had never done a residency before. It was at that time, it was a really interesting, weird experience to me, especially in Alaska in the middle of the summer when there's only like 2 hours of not even like darkness, like twilight.
Yeah. Was this during, before, or after your MFA that you were doing this?
It was actually during it. It was after my first year,
okay,
my MFA. So I, at that point, was really getting involved in performative works. Though I look back on this more as like the bed was totally this just amazing sculptural feat.
Yeah. Was it difficult to build?
When I planned it out with the help of the crew that was there at the time, the other artists in residence and Chuck who runs the residency, we weren't sure how much it was going to weigh, we had really estimated that we could probably cut it up, roll it, and put it on a wheelbarrow. And then we started rolling about a foot of the tundra, and it was more, probably weighed more than like the three people trying to roll it. So a lot of people in Alaska have random equipment on their properties, and the Cheneys just happened to have a forklift. Forklift and a backhoe. So
the whole piece ended up weighing several hundred pounds, like,
yeah,
800 pounds of sod.
Yeah, essentially. It's pretty dense, because, I don't know, you know, tundra is actually a lot of... Tundra itself is sort of, like, miniaturized, like, full-grown plants, so there's lots of, like, little pine trees in it and things like that, so it's kind of... It's way more dense than grass. It's more mossy almost. It took a lot, and it just sits, you know, just above the permafrost too, which in order to get it, there's like a certain limit of inches you can get. But it sits really well together because of the strong roots from it all being miniaturized plants.
It looks kind of like a huge pile of moss or something.
There isn't a lot of difference, just the sort of like plant varieties a little bit different. Mm-hmm. So there's like a twin size mattress and a pillow. Mm-hmm. We had actually cut two pillows out of it, and it was originally about a full size mattress, but I had to cut it kind of smaller with a sod cutter in order to first actually be able to move it. And we moved it to a clearing sort of at the edge of the property, where sort of wilderness, I guess, begins. Mm.
Looks like you're in the middle of nowhere in the photo, but I'm sure something could be right behind you.
Yeah, well, it's pretty much in the middle of nowhere. It's the Parks Highway runs about a mile and a half to the front of the property, and there's another unfinished housing development to one side. But it's pretty isolated. There were moose live on the property, like, and the last couple of days I was there, there was actually bear sightings on property too. It's isolated enough that you know, it really did, at least to me, it felt like my idea of what wilderness is. I mean, I don't know, wilderness is sort of this constructed idea, so it's you know, it's really what I felt. It was the closest I had experienced. So.
And so what exactly sparked the idea to build a bed outside out of the tundra?
Well, I'm really playing with this idea of comfort at, like, sort of the edges of where I was, of being someplace I had nothing, that was nothing like anything I had really experienced before. And how unsettling the whole experience was.
And it says that you attempted to sleep on this bed a couple times, and
I did probably a half hour session and just really struggled at getting comfortable. It was really buggy. You have to wear layers of DEET. So the second time was actually I did fall asleep, but just purely out of exhaustion, out of like days of trying to deal kind of like with the situation, the environment. You know, really sensitive light sleeper. So by the second session, I don't think I had slept in like 3 days.
Yeah.
Everybody's on strange schedules when you get up there too, because of the near permanent sunlight. So.
Yeah, it wasn't dark anyway. So.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, it was really one of those things that I think happens at residencies, where you sometimes make work you wouldn't normally make because the situation's just so different from how you live the rest of your life. And it's a piece I find really compelling, but it's also not something I ever knew how to expound upon more, you know? And so it's always kind of sat there. It's just this really weird sort of singular thing in my body of work.
And that concludes this episode of Studio Sessions with our guest Kirk Snow. You can find his work online at kirkamoralsnow.com. You can also learn more about me at my website, mattkuhlman.com. If you'd like to support this program, you can send a donation through PayPal to studiosessionspodcast@gmail.com. Even if you only send $1, your donation helps guarantee that I can continue providing interviews with interesting artists for your listening pleasure. And of course, don't forget to visit bigredandshiny.com for future episodes, along with other high-quality arts and culture content. Thank you for listening, and see you next time on Studio Sessions.